Chapter 40. Davin rested his rifle on his knees, he and Tar squatting next to him behind a red granite boulder. A canyon breeze carried the frigid breath of the high ice on the mountain passes, chilling their skin as it blew past them. In front of them, a column of Cretesian soldiers snaked along the creek, heading in the direction of Windgate. Davin and his companions had left Jun'Kal after the midday meal. By that time much of his strength had returned, though he still felt a little wobbly in the knees and light in the head. Scaling down the granite cliff proved even more challenging than scaling up it. Though the two sisters had the knack of it and used mockery as a tool to inspire him to quicker efforts. They had traversed the slope of the mountain down a steep, winding trail that cut confusing turns through trickling sluices and behind outcroppings of granite that ice and snow had cracked and dragged off the mountain. The vigorous breeze whistled through the needles of dense spruce that provided excellent concealment from every direction. As they had neared the swollen creek that flowed toward Windgate, the sound of marching feet and grumbling men pulled them up short. Tar had ordered he and Ki to stay there while she sneaked ahead. She'd returned with the dire news.
"The Cretesians march west along the creek. Single file. Only about a third of them are armed, but we can't go south without crossing that line."
After her report, she had guided them forward to the granite boulder where they now waited, which afforded them a good view of the men walking by about 50 feet below them. Davin peeked around the boulder, watching as the emaciated soldiers in baggy, yellowing-white uniforms trudged by. They wore black belts and black boots, and from Davin's vantage point, they looked like a row of children who had put on their parents' clothes. Reports of hard times in Cretus had not been exaggerated. These men were hungry. But their presence signalled both relief and grave danger. Ki and Tar now knew that the Cretesians had not discovered Jun'Kal or amassed an army to exterminate the Aur Catan. Unfortunately, they had found some way to pass through what once were thought impassable mountains and attack Belshire from the north, where no one would expect it. Davin cursed the delay. How long was the column? They were well into afternoon now, and he had wanted to get south of Windgate before the day was out. Cretesians obstructed their passage while increasing the urgency of their mission. Had anyone from Windgate been able to escape, to take news to Belshire?
"I see the anger in your eyes, brown man," Ki said, "but we cannot move. We must wait for a break in their march. Above all, we cannot have the Cretesians scouring this part of the mountain. If they found Jun'Kal, it would be the end of our people."
Davin slumped down, leaning against the lumpy boulder. Curse the luck. Ki and Tar bracketed him, pulling out their own pouches and carvings that he had seen them working on earlier. He pulled out his own carving bag, setting to work on something for Ariane. He'd found the wood by the communal fire in the park, a straight, round stick. What he was shown to carve, he didn't quite understand. In the wood, he saw an array of rings, with grooves on the inside and outside. He set the blade to the wood, knife flicking furiously and precisely, his companions just staring in amazement. For Davin, skill had nothing to do with it, his hands not his own. After an hour he realized that the objects he had crafted looked a lot like what the sisters worked on, only he used wood instead of bone. On each ring he carved, he created a flat space on one edge. Using the tip of his knife he carved a rune on this space, a symbol whose significance he did not know. There were 5 rings in total, and he had completed 2 when Ki stopped him.
"Do you even know what you are making?"
"No," he said.
"They are for your woman, are they not?"
"Yes."
"How would you know that?"
She and Tar looked at each other and smiled.
"They are for a woman. You will give them to her. They are for her hair. Did you notice some of the women wearing them in Jun'Kal?"
Davin thought back. He had seen rings in the hair of a few of the women once he thought about it.
"Yes, I did.
They are for decoration?" They smiled knowingly at each other again.
"Mostly."
"Why don't either of you wear them?"
They shrugged in unison, though Davin suspected they were simply avoiding answering him for some mischievous purpose of their own. He examined the one he was working on.
"You are doing quite well. Continue."
There was something he was missing. But as he set his knife to his 3rd ring, he realized the sound of marching and talking had faded. Tar had noticed it too, and she slunk around the edge of the boulder, returning a couple of minutes later.
"There is a gap in the line," she reported. "There is another column coming up about a mile back. If we are careful, we can pass in the space between. It would be safer to wait until dark, I think.
We go now, Davin said.
They stowed their carving materials, Tar leading them out, keeping to the trees and behind boulders as much as possible. Once they reached the creek, Davin found a wide trail.
Where does this go? He whispered.
It leads back into the ice mines, Key said. Now we need to run to get distance from the column behind us. We only have to follow this path for about a mile before we will turn onto a separate trail to the south.
The worn dirt path and the gurgling stream at its side made for quick and silent running, but as they turned an abrupt corner they found three Cretesian soldiers milling about by the creek, their shirts they had cast aside as they bathed, their malnourished ribs poking out against the skin. Stubbly faces stretched wide with surprise at an armed man and two Aurkatan women. The Cretesians had one weapon between them cast aside on the ground and one went for it. Key and Tar didn't hesitate, spears sailing through the air. The first two had barely opened their mouths to yell when the glassy spearheads punched through their chests. They fell without a scream. Davin reversed his rifle, bludgeoning the remaining Cretesian over the head just as the soldier brought his rifle up. The sisters retrieved their spears.
We can't leave these bodies here, Tar pointed out.
We have little time to move them, Key reminded her.
Footsteps at their rear already sounded alarmingly close. Davin grabbed his victim by the hands.
Let's put them under the branches of that spruce. It's the best we can do.
Key and Tar lifted one while Davin took care of the other two. Only a close examination would reveal their presence, and Davin hoped it would do. Key grabbed the Cretesian rifle and ammunition pouch.
You will show me how to shoot, brown man, Key said as they jogged away.
Father and the Acor won't like it, Tar admonished.
That hasn't stopped us before, Key observed.
Tar didn't argue. They sprinted now, evening shadows deepening in the canyon. With guns and spears at the ready, they crossed the creek where it widened out, a place Davin remembered from the sound when he was blindfolded.
Now we move off the path, Tar said,
and they dove into what appeared to be an impossibly dense thicket of spruce. Once they had pushed past the first branches, a serpentine corridor between the trees revealed itself. They traversed the dim pathway quickly, as it rose up a slight incline on the other side of the canyon, before turning west along a level track that led them out of the canyon proper and into the foothills beyond. Davin's senses were alive, and he hoped against hope that they were past any danger. He would brook no more delays. They kept to a deep gully as the foliage thinned on the wind-blasted slopes of the hills. The evening light outside the canyon still possessed enough strength to cast warm shadows and bead sweat on their skin as they turned south. To the west, smoke from numerous fires rose into the sky, creating a haze that clung to the land around them. Davin held them up.
I need to see what happened at Windgate so I can report it. It should be visible just over this rise.
His companions nodded and followed him up the hill, the thick bladed grass swishing at their pant legs and concealing rocks that tripped them up. As they approached the crest, they dropped to their bellies and crawled to the top. The buildings of Windgate were still standing, but instead of rough-and-tumble ice miners, a host of Cretesians filled the town and spilled out onto the arid plain beyond. Soldiers milled about tents pitched in precise, orderly rows, though the fires were scarce for an army of its size. There wasn't much to burn out on the plain. But of most alarm was a line of wagons along the road. As the men filed out of the canyon and through the town, soldiers on the wagons would issue a weapon to those of their fellows not fortunate enough to already possess one. Davin clenched his jaw. Whoever had paid into the Aid Society Fund, or made payments to Justice Page and Baron Longford, had put rifles into the bony hands of their enemies. Davin wondered why anyone would support such a traitorous scheme. They reversed down the hill and took refreshment to give them strength for a long hike south. Davin paced distractedly, trying to put his thoughts together. Why would Lord Caunton of Hightower have joined in with such a plot? Why empower the Cretesians to make war against the northern duchies of Bittermarch when he and his lands would be likely victims of the war? The warmer climes of the southern duchies would be a much more plausible target for the starving Cretesians. Key put a hand on his arm.
We should move. We will travel well into the night to get away from this horde. It is fortunate that they have no horses.
I think they ate them all, Davin said,
and not in jest.
But you are right. If we can get south of the main army, we will escape.
They must have scouts and lookouts on the road, so we will need to stay in the wild for a day or two. If we can't find horses after that, I will attempt to turn into a beast again and run it. If I am forced to leave you behind, meet me at Hightower.
The sisters nodded, and they jogged away into the deepening shadows of twilight. Ariane had dressed as Mr. Red had instructed, accentuating her femininity with her long, dark tresses floating about her shoulders and wearing a brightly coloured gown. It was the same gown she wore that had attracted a compliment from Davin, and she half hoped it might attract the man himself to finally show his brown face during the trial. Mr. Red assured her that her wardrobe and appearance would build sympathy with the judge, but the judge's deep-set eyes bore no boyish twinkle of admiration or attraction to give her hope. His pudgy, aged face regarded her as if he was completely unimpressed, a man who had tired of beautiful faces and shapely forms. Even so, Mr. Red informed her that by nature, people trusted and valued physical beauty, regardless of the character of the mind and soul. The second part of Mr. Red's advice she would not countenance. She would not act like a naive, innocent girl who was too stupid to even understand what her husband or clerks were up to while she sat in the drawing room embroidering cushions and gossiping with her lady's maids. If stupidity was to be levelled at her, it would be a stupidity of neglect, not intellect. A silly girl she was not, and she wouldn't stoop to dissembling. She had given testimony for 2 hours under a withering barrage from Mr. Gutke. Questions clearly designed to trip her up and cause her to contradict herself. She had little difficulty with these, as there was nothing to conceal. Mr. Red congratulated her during a brief break, but even after 2 hours' worth of denials and adamant assertions of her innocence, Mr. Gutke had apparently not exhausted his available lines of questioning. Ariane rubbed her neck. The mental exertion had steadily taken its toll, her headache building to a roar.
"How much longer can he go on?" she asked Mr. Red.
"He must be close now," he assured her. "I can't imagine he has much left that he can bring against you."
Judge Pinkerton banged his gavel, and Ariane made her way to the witness stand again, trying to appear as comfortable and at ease as possible. The invisible blacksmith hammering at the back of her skull didn't help. Mr. Gutke approached the stand, his strong nose and long face regarding her like a problematic nut he needed to crack. This man believed she was guilty, and throughout all of his questioning, she could see him searching for that one last opening that would force out all of her supposed traitorous secrets. As yet, he had not brought out the letter written in her husband's hand. Mr. Red warned her he would end with it for dramatic effect. Mr. Gutke rubbed his chin, dull eyes, absorbing her every reaction.
"Lady Hightower, I wish to return to the events surrounding the ledgers of your estate. Why was Baron Carver, then acting under the name David Harper, sent to your estate in the first place?"
"In the wake of the Aid Society scandal, the Queen wished him to examine my ledgers for irregularities. At least that is what she told me when she informed me of his impending visit."
"Now, you claim that he informed you of the problems in the ledgers and offered to take them back to Belshire, correct?"
"Yes."
"Why did you deny his request?" he probed.
"I felt the more prudent course would be to hire an armed guard and travel together, sparing both of us the danger."
There was that barely perceptible sliver of a grin forming on Mr. Gutke's face, the same one that appeared every time he thought he had a question that would break her.
"And, Lady Hightower, did you know at this time that David Harper was indeed Baron Carver in disguise?"
She blinked. Unexpected indeed. Mr. Gutke smiled smugly, no doubt thinking he had put her off balance. Now, he had, just a little. She collected herself.
"I did."
The audience gasped at this revelation, though Ariane couldn't fathom why it should matter. He approached the witness stand, face brightened by his small victory.
"And this was the same man who murdered your husband, correct?"
"No, it..."
"No?" Mr. Gutke exploded. "It is a matter of history and public record. How can you deny it?"
"It was a sanctioned duel," she said evenly. "Accepted by both parties and properly witnessed and registered. That is not murder, Mr. Gutke."
His eye twitched, just a little. A point scored.
"But Lady Hightower, this man killed your husband. Are you going to claim that you didn't wish to see him in any danger? He robbed you of your lord. Anger and a desire for revenge are perfectly natural. Isn't it true that you didn't wish him leaving with the ledgers because you didn't want them leaving your control before you could destroy them?"
"I didn't wish him to leave because I cared for him, even then."
While furious at Davin's absence, somehow her regard for him fortified her.
"Mr. Gutke, I will inform you that the manor house at Hightower has 10 fireplaces. Had I any incriminating evidence, or were I the criminal you think I am, I certainly would have availed myself of any one of them long before Baron Carver arrived at my door and been done with this business. I need no man's help to toss a book into a fire."
His thin-lipped smile disappeared, and he tromped to the evidence desk by Judge Pinkerton, retrieving the letter and returning to thrust it into her face.
"Lady Hightower," he said, voice harsh, "is this your husband's handwriting?"
"It could be," she answered.
Mr. Red had instructed her to respond in this fashion to the inevitable question.
"Could be,"
Mr. Gutke said.
"Is it, or is it not?"
"Mr. Gutke, I am perfectly sincere in my response. From what I remember, it is like it, but there may be 200 other gentlemen who write after the same fashion. His name does not adorn the parchment, so I cannot say with any certainty."
He stripped the letter from her with a swipe of his hand.
"Your Honour, I will read this letter. Be aware that our experts attest that the handwriting matches that of Lord Caunton and was written using fake names."
Mr. Gutke read the letter, inserting a great deal of drama and emphasizing,
"My wife and I are in complete agreement," with a healthy dash of relish.
He finished and turned toward her.
"What do you make of that, Lady Hightower?"
She shrugged. "It is a letter I never saw until Mr. Red showed it to me. It concerns an investment I was not aware of, and was written by a man who may or may not have been my husband. I am afraid it is a complete mystery to me, and I can offer no insight."
"It is written in your husband's hand."
"Objection," Mr. Red thundered. "We only know that it closely matches her husband's hand, and, as no one witnessed anyone write it, it could be a forgery."
"Sustained," Judge Pinkerton said,
and Ariane's hope leapt within her. Mr. Gutke was angry and defeated, and something about the judge's demeanour had changed, his bored eyes regarding her with some emotion. Respect?
"Do you have any further witnesses, Mr. Gutke?"
the judge asked.
"Nope."
"Do you wish to call anyone to the stand, Mr. Red?"
Ariane turned to regard her defender. Only Davin Carver remained on the list of people both sides had agreed to examine publicly, and as he had quite disappeared, there was nothing else to be done.
"No, Your Honour."
Judge Pinkerton rose and everyone followed suit.
"Very well. I shall retire to my chambers and return with the verdict within the hour."
He left, and Ariane returned to Mr. Red. They both took some satisfaction in the scowls of Mr. Gutke and his associates. Mr. Red beamed at her.
"If only all my clients were as composed and in control as you, though your innocence certainly lends you strength."
She smiled. "Thank you. What do you think of our chances?"
"You have won the day, Lady Hightower. I am sure of it,"
he said, returning his notes and documents to his satchel.
"There is simply too much reasonable doubt to convict you. And,"
he dropped his voice to a whisper,
"you can tell that Mr. Gutke knows it too."
Judge Pinkerton returned a half an hour later, and immediately upon seeing him, her heart fell clanging into the pit of her stomach. His entire countenance had changed. As the late afternoon light fell upon him, he appeared as pallid and sweaty as the wounded Mr. Cranton had earlier that day. As he sat and perused a document, Ariane could detect a slight trembling of his hands. She turned to Mr. Red, whose gaze was also fixed worriedly on the judge. Ariane caught Mr. Red's eyes, and he shrugged. It seemed that Judge Pinkerton had suddenly taken ill.
"Let the accused come forward," he said, voice resigned.
Ariane rose and approached the witness stand, heart hammering and hands clammy. Judge Pinkerton's eyes took her in, and she saw pity there, and fear. Why were his hands shaking?
"It is the decision of this court that Lady Ariane Hightower is guilty of treason. As Bittermarch is on a war footing, there will be no appeals and no delays. The sentence of drowning will be carried out tomorrow at noon. Court is adjourned. Remand her into custody."
Ariane couldn't breathe. Judge Pinkerton abandoned his chair and practically fled to his chambers, while gasps of outrage and cheers of victory commingled in the spacious hall. Before she could think, the Lord High Sheriff was at her side.
"I am sorry, Lady Hightower," he said, face hard. "Come with me."